I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, too. So that you won't be sorry you stayed after lunch. I'm going to tell you, this a couple of times throughout the course of the lesson today. Nothing would please me more than if you did have a couple of questions at the end. And what would even please me more than that? To be able to answer them. I have no guarantee that I would be able to. But if people have questions, usually it's something somebody else has thought about too. So if you do have a question, you're hesitant about asking it, you know, the worst thing that will happen to you is either or something like that. Yeah, if it's really, we do reserve the right to ask, there's a laugh if you ask a really, really, really funny question. But it'll be good nature. So, I'm supposed to talk to you about events in the Bible that might have been verified by archaeologists. Now, archaeology is, we usually think of as being artifacts that have been dug up. Not all of them are dug up, but basically it's a study of artifacts. And you're looking for information where you're finding artifacts. Now, one thing I want to tell you to start up. All right, number one, I'm not an expert in this field. And I want to make sure that you know that. But the second thing is that I do know this. A lot of times we are thinking that if we knew all the information there was in the world regarding artifacts that have been discovered, we would find the smoking gun. Like, we're going to dig up, I don't know, a picture of Jesus walking out of the tomb after he's been killed. That's not going to happen. This isn't about smoking gun. This isn't about, most of the time it isn't about, I have absolutely proved a supposition, or I should say a proposition from the Bible. Most of the time it's not that. Most of the time, it comes under the heading of providing us with background information. But there are some notable exceptions. One of them we're going to start up with pretty quickly. I didn't want to divide this material. I just decided to say really ancient things, less ancient than the New Testament things. And none of this is very, ooh, that happened in the wrong order, didn't it? But anyway, none of this is anything that you can't look up on your own. And all this is going in the wrong order, so we'll just go with that. I wanted to mention a couple of things. There's a rule that we use when we're thinking, analyzing material. You're not too young to know this rule, and you're not too old to know this rule. We call it the law of rationality. And that means that we ought to only accept as true those things for which there's sufficient evidence. Let me say that again. We ought to accept as true only those things for which there is sufficient evidence. Well, what does that mean to us when we're talking about the Bible? Because sometimes people approach what the Bible claims to be true, and you might get this reaction, well, you know, the Bible says it's true, and it is true, and don't ask questions. Well, you didn't really help the person asking the question, because you're kind of reasoning in a circular way. Now, what is a better approach is to say this. What I can verify, I ought to verify. Now, are there some things in the Bible that cannot be verified? Absolutely. When God created the world, now I think we can sort of verify that. But what about, let's take something like the order of the days of creation. Is there any way to verify that except what Moses wrote? There's no way to verify. If the order is wrong of the days, and I don't mean talk about how long the days are, understand, even if you accept the Bible account, there were 6 days of creation. You just kind of have to accept that Moses wrote it accurately. Okay, that leads us to the next question. There's something called credibility. that comes in here. Okay? And explain what credibility is. If you know someone for 20 years, and each and every time you speak to that person, he tells a great big fat lie. And he tells you something the next time you meet him, are you likely to believe him or to doubt that? Well, you're going to doubt. Why? He has zero credibility. If, on the other hand, somebody consistently tells you the truth all the time, if that person tells you something because he has credibility, you're likely to believe him, right? Okay? Back in 1987, near as I can remember, I was driving through Wheeling, West Virginia. I don't remember why. I was by myself. If I was in Wheeling those days, I was probably going to see somebody in the hospital, but I honestly don't remember. I might have been picking Mary up from school because she was going to West Liberty at the time. I was driving, I was minding my own business. And at that point in my life, I did not know that the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile existed. I saw Mary Ann and I said, and you know what's funny? I called it the Wienermobile. I just thought that's later found out that's what they call it. I said, you don't believe this, I just saw the Wienermobile. She said, a what? I said, a Wienermobile. It was a giant hot dog. And the guy was driving it. I'd love to tell you that because I had never told her anything that wasn't true, and she believed every word of it, but she basically accused me of either being lying, being drunk, stupid, crazy. I think all those were the options that she said. I had no credibility, and I saw the Wienermobile. So, same thing happened like 4 years ago. I'm driving down the interstate to preach one Sunday morning. Here goes the Batmobile. I saw the Batmobile. I guess Batman goes to church. And I feel it now. And I actually, fortunately for the internet, I found out there's a guy in Huntington that drives around in a Batmobile and he does these programs. But again, it was a really good Batmobile. I did not see the Joker, but I did see the Batman. But it's all about credibility. Now, here's the point. If you go into the Bible and you're thinking about Bible events, and those things that can be verified are verified, what does that do for you on the things that there's no way you can verify? So in other words, you've got five books of Moses, and every time Moses mentions a place, a person, an event, every time that you can verify it, it is verified. When you go to the first two chapters, and Moses then writes, here's what happened on the first day. God created the universe and created life. Here's what happened on the second day. God, all the way through the 6 days. I'm not gonna recite that. I'm sure you know it. But that's how I know and I'm confident what God said. That's the law of rationality. That's what Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21. Test all things, hold fast to that which is good. All right, let's go through very quickly a couple of ancient events. This is out of order, by the way, because it actually took place after the flood. I'm going to talk to you about the flood in a minute. But what you're seeing here are a couple of pictures of some very important sites from ancient Mesopotamia. The one on top is, of course, what it would have looked like at the time. The one on the bottom is how it appears now. This is called a ziggurat. The ziggurats were constructed in ancient Mesopotamia, which would be modern-day Iraq, and between the Tigris and Euphrates. And nobody really is sure what they were. They're kind of like Egyptian pyramids, maybe not as big, but they're quite impressive. But what's interesting is to compare these ziggurat ruins from the ancient Sumerian culture, and you think about what happened in Genesis chapter 11 with the Tower of Babel. And you remember, they said, we're going to make this tower, we're going to make it up to heaven, and don't misunderstand that. They use heaven to mean sky. So I don't think they thought they were going to get God's dwelling place, but they said we're going to build this tower way up in the sky. Now, that probably is what they were doing. And what's really interesting is the biggest one that they've ever found, it was called the High Hill of God. And it sort of corresponds to what you read in Genesis 11. Now, did we prove that that's the one they were building at Babel? No. But we certainly demonstrate that they were doing things like that. And if you ask me, if you ask my opinion, I think that was probably the one based on what they called it. Well, what about the flood? Now, I'm not going to, again, because of time, because if we go into everything involved in the flood, that's all we're going to cover is the flood. But I want to start and really confine our thinking to just one thing, that is flood. And this is it's a really odd circumstance that we're in right now. It has been actually for some time. Now, when we start disputing the flood, now, by the way, the Bible says in no uncertain terms what happened and how far it extended. I mean, the language is unmistakable. You cannot read Genesis chapter 6 through 9 and the other references to the flood, for instance, that Jesus made Matthew 24, Peter referenced it twice in his two epistles. But you can't read any of that to come up with anything other than this flood covered the entire earth. Okay, so we have a proposition. Proposition is flood covered the earth. All right. Now, we have a whole array of beliefs connected with that. One of those beliefs is the Bible is parable history. That's one thing we have connected with it. We have the notion of creation as described in the Bible connected with that. We have how old is the earth connected with that. We have that all mankind has come down and descended not just from Adam, but from one other one man, and that's Noah. Connected here. We also have connected with the flood, as described in Genesis, another chronology that says everything was wiped off the face of the earth, that's exactly 4,200 years ago. Okay? That's a lot of stuff. Yes. Alright. That's the one side. Over on this side are people who dispute this. And one of the things that they do, and I don't know that everybody does this intentionally, okay? But one of the things that they do is oftentimes point to a mountain of evidence that doesn't really prove what they think proves. Okay? Now, I have heard people do this. So I'm not supposing that people might do this. I've heard people do this. And there's something like this. You believe the Bible? Yes, I do. You believe what the Bible says about the age of the earth and the flood and all? Yes, I do. And here comes what is thought to be the question that shuts it all down. And the question is, but what about fossils? See, that new born full of fossils. That fossils at the house, the fossils, you know, they're not uncommon. It's not like we've never heard of fossils. But the question is, what about the fossils? It is thought by some there's a museum full of fossils, and the fossils disprove the Bible. Now, I wouldn't within tribes go into everything that's just entailed. All I'm going to do is make one point. Now, before I make that one point, what I want to do is make sure you understand something.
people do things with evidence, sometimes intentionally, sometimes unintentionally. And what they do is misinterpret evidence. Okay? Listen so far.
Right.
So, the question remains, what about the fossils? There's a museum full of fossils. Now, sometimes I've actually known some people who would say, well, that stuff's worthless, and they might even say there were no such things as dinosaurs. Well, okay, when it comes to fossils and fossil evidence, sometimes it's pretty iffy what they do with fossils. For instance, you know, you can take a tooth and turn it into a semi-human. Or so they thought. You can't really take a tooth and turn it into a semi-human, but that's what's been done. But in the case of this rascal, that's not a tooth, and I don't care if it doesn't have any flesh on it, I can see pretty much what that thing looks like, right? You can see. I think this is the one from Carnegie. I've seen this one a couple of times live in person, but that thing lives, okay? There's no doubt that that thing lives, and you know, there's a lot of other questions about it, but that thing lives, okay? So we don't want to say this didn't happen. This thing lives. They used to call it a brontosaurus, now they argue back and forth, and they say it's just a kind of a parasaurus, I guess. Most of them are, although some of them are still holding out. But I'm really disappointed that there's no such thing as a brontosaurus, because I remember that Fred Flintstone, you see, was a brontosaurus rib, you know, so I'm kind of disappointed. But anyway, this is not a matter of finding a tooth and then constructing a living being based on the tooth. They found the whole thing, all right? That's how big it was. That's what it looked like with some flesh on it, but that's the thing. Okay, here's the big question as it relates to the flood. And this is where I always go with the flood. All right. Can I demonstrate to people that the flood of Noah took place? Yes, I can. I can because fossils exist. See, people won't realize the fact that there are museums full of fossils is not a problem for me, because fossils wouldn't exist if it were not for the flood. And I always ask people, I say, you know, when you see a deer that got killed out on the highway, and maybe the state road didn't pick it up and it sits there like it does sometimes, a month later, what do you have? Jane said a mess. Okay? It's deteriorated somewhat, has it not? Okay, if it sits there for 6 months, what do you expect to see? Well, not 6 months. I'd expect to see skeleton in 6 months. You're a little ahead of me. Just would be the next stage. What happened to the deer? Where did it go? She said it reverted back to what it was.
Yeah.
Various scavengers worked on it. Vultures. Awesome. Various insects got a hold of it. And what was working on it the whole time? Just invisible. Huh? Bacteria. Breaking it down the whole time until it's the same. If nobody cleans it up, a year and a half later, what's left? Nothing. Now, it didn't really turn into nothing. But as far as, did it turn into a fossil? The question is, why are there so many fossils? Then, you have to have a really odd set of circumstances to get a fossil. You have to bury the carcass so deep that the bacteria and the other more immediate scavengers don't even have an opportunity. You have to bury it in mud. You have to drop it in the car pit. You have to cover it with something. Ice, that counts as a fossil, by the way, when you're frozen to death. But something strange like that has to happen. And so in various places on the earth, when you look for fossils, you find just this honey hole of fossils, and the fossils that are widespread, new, as though something piled over all at once. Now, does that absolutely prove the flood? No. it does prove that either the flood or something like it happened. And the simplest, easiest, most direct, and I think the most reasonable answer is, because those things do exist, the flood happened.
Now, I'll take this to go into some more stuff. If this ever pans out, this might be that home run Smoking Gun I was talking about. When I was young, we used to say different things about the ark than we do today.
Most of the time it was the reason that nothing was ever found with the ark that Noah built was because that they would have utilized the material. And the people who reasoned that way, including me when I was young, didn't really take into account where that it was. If you remember, when the ark came to rest, it came to rest not on Ararat, but on the mountains of Ararat. And if this is it, it's way up on the mountain. It's not up at the top of Ararat. It's 20,000 feet above sea level. But it's considerably up there. It's up there far enough that if you're Noah and his family, you will not survive the weather up there. So would they have used the material in the ark? No. They'd be in survival mode. They would get down off that mountain where they could survive. And so for many years, in fact, I think since the 50s, this particular site that you're seeing an aerial photo of has been proposed as the remains of the ark. And since, I would say, over the last 20 years, it appears to have become much more credible for a couple of reasons. Number one, what in the world is that thing doing up there where nobody is and where human habitation isn't really practical? And the size of it is part of the thing. I mean, one of the things that's most impressive about the ark was the extraordinary size of it. If you do the math, it appears to be about 550 feet long. And everything about this corresponds. And if you have an object that big, even 4,200 years, if you're way up on the mountain, it's pretty dry, it's very cold. Yeah, it's reasonable to say it could have survived that long. Now, is that it? I didn't say I knew that. I said it is looking more and more credible as years go by. Now, let's talk about some things that are a little less ancient. This is a place that I've been to. This is Jericho. I know you remember the story of Jericho as written in the early chapters of Joshua. Now, when Jericho was first excavated, and if I remember right, that would be about 1920. It was excavated by an archaeologist by the name of John Garstang. Garstang found that the walls had been pushed outward and burned with intense heat, which corresponds exactly with what the Bible tells us. Now, the chronology of the fall of Jericho, if the Exodus took place at 14, it would be right at 1400 B.C., which is right where he placed it. A later archaeologist by the name of Kathleen Kenyon came along in the early 40s, maybe the late 30s, I don't remember off the top of my head. She disputed Dave Garstang's ideas. But here's what's interesting about Kenyon. Kathleen Kenyon said the problem with Garstang was he had an agenda. What was his agenda? He was a Bible believer. She was not. So, the funny thing about that, and I'm just throwing that in for your consideration, is this. Yeah, she had an agenda, and yes, she had one too. And sometimes people on the skeptical side say, the problem with you is you have an agenda. And my response is, yes, I do, and I acknowledge it. Your problem is you have one, you're pretending that you're being objective, which is way more dangerous. So, anyway, she challenged these dates, and she did it through very, in my opinion, very unreliable means. She was dating it from the pottery thereabout. Later investigators also challenged her findings, saying these things were from an entirely different time. But the problem that people who disbelieve the Bible had with this, quite frankly, is it was too good. What do you mean too good? I mean, it corresponds exactly to what the Bible says. That troubles them. How so? One of the things they found out about Jericho, And this isn't my picture, but I've got a picture of that exact same wall that I took about 2 years ago. But one of the things that they found was it was a double wall. So imagine a circle, and then within that another circle. Those are the two walls. And then it kind of had spokes that connected the walls. Now, why is that important? You might remember this, and if you don't, look it up. We're talking about, what, the first four chapters of Joshua. You remember Rahab? The Bible said her home was in the wall. How can somebody live in a wall? Well, what Garstang found was those folks were kind of hollow. They weren't solid walls. They were just, it was kind of like they built homes that connected the two walls. So your home would be from one wall to the other. So she literally lived in the wall, just like the Bible says. Now the question you might have is, okay, even if you don't believe any of this, you don't believe God caused this to happen, whatever, how do you explain how that Joshua describes one woman in the town of Jericho and describes not only what she did for a living, but exactly where she lived, and then you come along, you know, 3,000 years later, and you find evidence that people lived exactly where she did. And that's a representation of what the wall might have looked like at the time. Now, also, they're a little less ancient. Okay? These are pictures of a couple of pretty important finds. Both of these actually from the 1800s. The one on your left is the Moabite stone. Now, the Moabite stone was important. Now, a fellow found it, and it was in Palestine, what's today is Israel. It seemed until 1947, Arabs controlled Palestine, and this guy was there. He found this. He wasn't sure what it was. And another, I think they were both British, but he comes in, he recognizes this is something really important. The problem was the Arabs decided it was an idol. And so the Moabite stone was crushed. They beat it in pieces. But before they beat it into pieces, they managed to get an impression on it. And from that impression, then they take it back and they study and Moab, whatever the language of Moab was, it was close enough to Hebrew that a Hebrew scholar could figure it out. And it turned out to be really important. It turned out to be a statement from a king of Moab. And here's what he mentioned. He said, I've been at war with Omri, king of Israel. And then he said, Omri died, and his son Ahab took the throne, and the hostilities have continued. Why is that important? Okay, Daniel showed you something. I want you to think about that statement and compare it to the statements that Gail shows you from the Gospel of Thomas. You know, the statements he shows you from the Gospel of Thomas, it's hard to take those serious, isn't it? I mean, just reading it on the surface, this is goofiness. You look at that, and if you didn't have any idea what the Bible was or where it came from, you look at that and say, man, I don't believe this. This is garbage. This, from the Moabite king, is obviously a serious statement. Not a frivolous statement, a serious statement. But when you compare that to what the Bible reads, you're learning a couple of things. Number one, it's verified. And number two, it was a serious statement of history. Because you read of King Ahab and Omri, you don't read much about him, but you read directly to the events that took place in their lives in the books of 1 Kings and 2 Chronicles. And also in the side. Now, the one on the right, and I know I'm hurrying because I'm desperate not to bore you. The best way to do that is just by talking fast and get through this. So the one on the right is called the prism, Taylor's prism. And I didn't throw in a picture. There's another one that does a similar thing called the Black Obelisk. But basically what this does, it was from the ancient nation of Assyria over about where Iraq is today.
and Assyria was fighting against the northern nation of Israel, the southern nation of Judah. Now, the king on the throne of Judah at the time was named Hezekiah. I'm sure most of you have heard of Hezekiah. Well, what's interesting about that prison is, this is from the enemy's point of view. And he tells, I destroyed Israel, I carried away X number of people from Israel, and this many donkeys, this much cattle, and this many captives, and blah, 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 blah. And now I'm fighting against Judah, and I've destroyed X number of cities, and you get to the end, and he says, and now I have Hezekiah tracked like a bird in the cage. That's the famous statement from that prison. Hezekiah is trapped like a bird in a cage in the city. Well, guess what? When you go to the books of 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and Isaiah 37, you find out that's exactly what was going on. That the Sennacherib, who was the king of Assyria at the time, had Jerusalem surrounded. And right there it is, and it perfectly corresponds to what we read in the Bible. Also under the heading of a little less ancient, something I'm going to skip because of time, because it'll take a long time to explain, but I am going to tell you about this place. Although it sort of goes on to there we're talking about what you're looking at right here is one of the caves at Qumran. Qumran is on the shore of the Dead Sea. Now, what's that have to do with archaeology? Well, in 1947, there was a boy at Qumran, and he was, guess what, his son Lot. Like kids do it. That's how they found maybe the most exciting find in the history of the world. Maybe. I mean, unless Indiana Jones actually found the Ark that's in a warehouse sometimes. That would be the only thing that's bigger than this. But this is the Dead Sea Scroll location. So he threw a rock, and it made a sound like it didn't hit a rock. And he was curious. So he climbs up there, and if that looks like a steep climb, I remember when I was there looking at that and thinking that kid must have been about half a goat to get up that place. So the picture, it's worse than the picture looks. So anyway, he goes up there and he finds a bunch of jars. And it turns out that there's scrolls that are deep in clay jars. And I actually have a small copy, and I forgot to bring it, but I'm going to show it to you, but you can look it up. But it's so it has scrolls, and the scrolls have various pieces of information in them. It's a really interesting story, you know, that somebody got them. It actually sat around for a couple of years. Somebody bought them, it mounted to a yard sale. It's kind of crazy, but it took a few years for it to get into the right hands. And today, the originals are in Jerusalem in a museum, and it's a really cool museum because it's shaped like a clay pot, and it actually has a thing that comes down over it. It's crazy, but it looks like a giant scroll pot. But anyway, what we did was, like I said, various things, but the most important thing was a whole lot of the book of Isaiah. And get this, you know what they were telling you about how far back our copies go? This one dated from 200 B.C. Now, I'm going to fire up a little bit of what Dale was telling you about. The printing press was invented by Johann Gutenberg in the 1500s. After that, we don't worry about copies because printing presses don't make human errors. They just copy what you tell them to copy. That's it. Before that, we were. So from 1500, when he was telling me, from 1500 back to the major the big pieces, you know, the Codex Sinaiticus and so on and so forth. That takes you back to like 300, and he mentioned he's right. The fragments, the little pieces, go back almost to the time of Christ. There's no doubt at all. But when it comes to Jewish literature, the Old Testament, there was a huge gap. What we did was we jumped, I don't know, 800 years one day. And so, if the Bible has been changing little by little all those years, and that's what they kept telling us. People kept making mistakes, and the Bible kept changing. Now we've jumped from something like 500 AD to 200 BC, which is the 700. And you know what happened when they compared the 200 BC Dead Sea Scrolls to the 500 AD copies we have? Guess what? No change. That was key. And it actually helped people in some of their translations of Scripture because it gave you some insight as to what was intended at the time, because there was some commentary there too. But that's what happened at Qumran. Now, the New Testament, I'm going to just give you a couple more things, and then hopefully we'll have 30 seconds for questions. The guy whose picture you're looking at there is William Ramsay. William Ramsay was a Scotsman in the 19th century who didn't read the Bible. And so he decided, I'm going to go to the Middle East, which wasn't commonly done in the 1800s, that I'm going to show why the Bible is a fraud. In the process, he managed to verify a ridiculous number of places that are mentioned, particularly in the book of Acts, and came away a believer in the integrity of the Bible based on his own investigation. Further study showed that the books that bear the most minute scrutiny as authority for the facts of the Aegean were the Aegean world, is where most of Paul's missionary work took place. And that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement. So what he's doing is he's checking all the place names in the book of Acts. And the book of Acts says this place was this far, it took us this long to get here. He would check that out. You know what he found? Exactly what? All those places are exactly where they should be. And he said, in fact, Luke, who wrote the book of Acts, you can press him beyond any other historian, and somehow or another, the rest of the book didn't end up there, but you can end up beyond any other historian's credibility, is basically what he was getting at. On the authorship of the Pauline epistles, he concluded that all 13 New Testament letters that claim to be written by Paul were written by Paul. Once upon a time, not too long ago, people were telling us the Bible was mistaken about Pilate. Remember Pilate? Well, the problem was secular history didn't record a Pilate. And so there was a lot of crowing going on. This is in Caesarea. And I used this picture. I've got a picture of this too someplace, but my picture isn't nearly as good. What they did was they kind of blew up the parts that were important so you could see it. I know you all don't read Latin. But you don't have to read Latin to figure out P-O-N-T-I-U-F. See that? They made U's that look like B's. So that's Pontius. Do you see this? P-I-L-A-T-U-S. Colossa. Pontius Pilate. And that was found at Caesarea on the coast of the Mediterranean. And that's actually a copy of that the original somewhere where you can't get to it. But they got that one right there where you can see it. And the point is, we knew the Bible was right all along. It's nice to have that stone discovered, but here's my point, and this is the part even if you're sleeping, I want you to hear this. After this happened this many times, and after you have this many occasions, and there are many, many more of outside evidence saying, oh, look here, this verified what the Bible said. After that happens a lot, at some point, the reasonable person says, you know what? The Bible has credibility. And maybe there are some things I can't verify externally. But at this point, that's where our faith comes in. And I don't mean faith like we started out with. Well, I just know everything in the Bible is true and don't even talk to anybody about anything else. I'm talking about an informed faith. I'm talking about verifying that everything that has been said in the Bible that we can compare, it turns out to be true and accurate. So therefore, I can trust my Bible even more than maybe I could before. So, that's, again, just a very, very cursory look at the matter. I do hope somebody might have a question or two that I might be able to answer. Every time I don't ask for questions, I get them. Every time I ask for questions, then I ask one. That's always the way it works. And I was hoping if I started out by saying that there's going to be a time for questions if you have one. But if you, oh, okay. How do I explain carbon dating? Is that something where you got that?
No.
Okay, she just wanted to know. Okay, let me give you the quickest answer I can. First off, carbon 14 dating is only good for relics, and I'm using the scale used by evolutionary thought. I don't think there is such a thing as 20,000 years ago, but according to them, carbon dating is only good for about 20,000 years. For the really old stuff, they use other methods, including potassium argon. Here's the problem with half-life dating. It uses extrapolation. And it relies on the doctrine, I'm going to use a huge word here, it relies on the doctrine of uniformitarianism. Uniformitarianism says everything that's happening right now is happening, it has always happened in the same way and at the same speed. Now, the problem with that is, first off, we know that last part simply isn't true. In fact, you can hardly think of anything less true than that. The more you think about things going on, yeah, there's a certain consistency, but the opposite of that is phenomenon of chaos. Now, I will give you an illustration. I'm sure some of you, the last 30 seconds, have sounded like Charlie Brown's teeth. You've been standing there and I've been going, womp, 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 womp. Okay, here's how it works. Illustration that I learned many years ago from somebody's dad who's in this audience, so I thought it was pretty good one and I remembered it ever since. If I see Jeff walking by my house in St. Mary's, up on the ridge, and I see him walking by my house at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I say, well, I'm going to calculate how fast Jeff's walking. And he's maybe walking 3 or 4 miles an hour. You live in Parker's Village, so that's like 40 miles from my house. So I look at Jeff walking and I say, my. That poor guy has been walking for 10 hours because I know where he lives and I can see how fast he's walking. So therefore, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, that poor guy has been walking since 11 o'clock last night. That poor guy. Now, but what I did was I made about 10 mistakes right there, didn't I? Number one, how do I know that he left his house? Number two, is there a more reasonable conclusion? Yeah. The first thing I would think if that happened, if I said, I don't know where he's going up here, but his car must have broken down off the road. And he didn't walk all the way here. He might have run part of the way, and that changes everything. Okay, how does that work with the age of the earth, with carbon dating and all that sort of thing? If a thing like the flood happened, it probably messed up all the dating methods badly because of the violence theory. And number two, just as the world is going along, all these things might be changing, that is, rates, even as we speak, and I suspect they are. Number three, I have specific evidence that refutes it. Like what? Well, next time you take a trip over to the eastern part of the state, I recommend to go into one of the famous caves, smoke holes, caverns, and spent a caverns. And they'll tell you that it takes 1 million years to get 1 inch of stalactite and 1 million years to grow an inch of stalagmite. And they'll say it with wonder and awe in their voice. And in the case of smoke holes, as I recall, then
About 20 minutes later, they'll show you an iron handrail and say, isn't that amazing? In the 100 years that thing has been here, I want you to look at the stalagmite and see what I've got. And when it happened to me, I said, did you not hear what you just said? Clearly, it doesn't take a million years. It took 100. That's a big difference. Unless you think that iron handrail has been there for a million years, we've got a problem. It does not take that long. I have specific evidence. There are stalactites and stalagmites growing in the basement of the Washington Monument. And coal, which takes millions of years to produce, is now at the bottom of Spirit Lake. Formed since Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980. The chronology that they give us is pure garbage. It's anarchy. It's alchemy. It really is. It's made up out of thin air. You take a tiny little set of data and you try to make general statements about what you have seen over the period of 20 years and how to make that consistent with billions. That's not math. I don't know what it is, but it's not math. The answer to this carbon dating is this. The longer you go with it, the less accurate it's going to be until it gets to the point where it is pure absurd nonsense and it does not take into consideration what changes might have taken place in the past. Okay, anybody else? Yes. This isn't bad math, is it? So the last time you asked me a question, you asked math, but it really took me a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And after the there
have been all kinds of expeditions to it, as far as a serious excavation. You can actually look up. They've taken a lot of artifacts from it. But as far as a real one and a serious one, I would have to say no. But there are various reasons for that, including the Turkish government, including where it is, how high it is. There's a lot of logistic problems to it. Anybody else?
Yeah, to take the law of rationality and prove the days as far as what was made.
Yes, I think you
could. Because of the rice, the veggies, I mean, that order, would that prove that that...
The fact that I think is what you're getting at, the order rules out anything other than a 24-hour day, because you'd have to have the light in order for the photosynthesis to work. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What are some other ancient that
do
not look like
that? You mean the ones I don't have time for? Well, the most obvious examples, I think, are in and around Jerusalem. But again, most of the time, I mean, you can go, they welcome amateurs. There's a saying among archaeologists, you need amateurs because they're the ones that only find good stuff. It's kind of like beginner's luck, I guess, but they have a kind of superstition about that. So you can, when you're a little older, Andrew, you can probably see those yourself. But most of the time, we're not digging up a document that says David was reigning as king in 1000 BC. Most of the time what you're going to find is, oh, here's how they lived life. Oh, here's what they did. Here's the kinds of things that were important to them at the time. And the best place to get that is garbage dumps. Archaeologists mostly excavate ancient garbage dumps. And that's where they find all this stuff. That's why the pottery is all broken. But yeah, there's all kind of them. The best site I've ever seen is one that's only as minor importance to the Bible, and that's Beth-Shan. And it won't ring a bell with anybody here, because you'd have to look it up. It looks like Beth-Shan, but it's not pronounced Beth-Shan. But it's an extraordinary site. It's got a great tell. A tell is a mound where the city used to be. It was kind of mound up. But the only significant thing I can think of that happened there is that's where they took Saul and his sons and packed him up on a wall after they killed him on Mount Gilboa. So if you look up at the end of 2 Samuel, that's where you would find it. But it's extraordinary. Now, here's another thing you find, Andrew. You find architecture, obviously. A lot of what we know about ancient architecture comes from archaeological digs. But, again, so far as finding that smoking gun is very rare, probably non-existent. But all that to say this, we're probably never going to find the Ark of the Covenant. There's all kind of thoughts about where it might be and it might have gone. It'd be pretty neat if we could find it, but I guess it's in that warehouse and stuff like that. Anybody else? Yes?
I think that, like,
unknowing through
the Bible,
how much of it has it? Like, the people who don't believe in
God, they find
something
that comes out of it. True, like, how much of it
is happening
now?
I would say most of it. I would say most of it, and this is why I made the statement again. There are many things in the Bible. Well, just think of it like this. The details of the Bible are not going to be found elsewhere as far as, let's go to the Old Testament. Do you know what a chronicle is? A chronicle is an official king's history. So when you read the books of 1st and 2nd Chronicles, you're reading the official history of kingdoms with this as inspiration. So the question, my question would be, and go through those books, why would any other nation have a detailed history of Israel and Judah? You feel what I'm saying? They're not. The only thing you want to have is when their paths cross. And that was that thing of synergy with the obelisk and the Moabite stone and Pharaoh's prison. Those were points at which the paths of Israel and Judah crossed for a nation. And at that point, that's what I meant about credibility, though. We're not going to get it all verified, and some people say, well, it doesn't need verified in the sense of life. But after a while, when you say, oh, wait, it's got it right here, every place I can check, it's got it right, then the reasonable person says, okay, this is something I can trust. Now, interestingly, some of the more important miraculous events have some external verification. For instance, the resurrection of Jesus is at least claimed outside of the Bible. Now, does that prove it? Because Josephus said a lot of people believe this? Not necessarily. But after a while, we have to ask ourselves, is this reasonable? Anybody else? Yes.
I just think, what is your thought? You ever heard about the flames of the Red Sea that found chariots at the bottom of the Red Sea?
I think it's highly questionable.
Okay.
I think, I've heard about satellite imaging showing that you could track where they went. And I think that's about the dumbest thing I ever heard of. You can't find footprints that are 3,500 years old. But the funny thing is, I think that is where they talked, where they. So I hope to be proved wrong someday. It's just that everybody and others are seeing investigate that. I found them highly flexible.
Okay.
Ron White is the guy that popularized that.
Oh, yeah.
You have to watch that guy like a hawk.
Well, he's not worth the
coming, too. Yeah. So, I actually agree with his conclusions. I just wish he had a all the rest of it, so it makes it a little less better. I think that's probably way more than the time I was allotted. Give me a thumbs up, so I guess I'm okay. Well, I want to go back to something that I don't know that I intended to make this the theme of the rest of the day, but it's kind of what it ended up being, and that's the theme of credibility. Here's what I want to leave you with. There are some people who say, I believe the Bible, but I'm not sure about some of these things we've been talking about. I'm not sure that so many people who are experts are wrong about how old the earth is. I'm not sure that I can believe that the entire earth is covered with water, but I believe in God, and I want to be safe. If you can't believe God, and what he has to say about creation, can you believe God when he says he that believes and is baptized shall be saved?
I don't think you can. If you can't believe God when he tells us that the entire earth is covered with water, I wonder, can you even really believe him? And Jesus said, God so loved the world. I don't know if you can believe anything about God. My point is this, either God is God and his word is truth, or here is a follow-up question. So, yeah, I think it is important that we do understand. By the way, I know it's important that we question, that we understand, that we question, that we find it credible, and then hear what Jesus has to say. Maybe you're not yet a Christian. And if that's the case, we're going to sing a song just a minute to invite you to come on. I want you to know that you can trust God. I want you to know you can trust Jesus when he said, come to me, all you that labor and heavy laden. You can trust him. I want you to know you can trust Jesus when he said he would believe and baptize for his faith. You can trust him. You're not a child of God. Don't come on this family.